relief. That was unpardonable, and Amy took no more notice of him for a long while, except a word now and then when she came to her chaperone between the dances for a necessary pin or a moment's rest. Her anger had a good effect, however, for she hid it under a smiling face, and seemed unusually blithe and brilliant. Laurie's eyes followed her with pleasure, for she neither romped nor sauntered, but danced with spirit and grace, making the delightful pastime what it should be. He very naturally fell to studying her from this new point of view, and before the evening was half over, had decided that little Amy was going to make a very charming woman. It was a lively scene, for soon the spirit of the social season took possession of everyone, and Christmas merriment made all faces shine, hearts happy, and heels light. The musicians fiddled, tooted, and banged as if they enjoyed it. Everybody danced who could, and those who couldn't admired their neighbors with uncommon warmth. The air was dark with Davises, and many Joneses gambolled like a flock of young giraffes. The golden secretary darted through the room like a meteor, with a dashing Frenchwoman who carpeted the floor with her pink satin train. The serene Teuton found the supper table and was happy, eating steadily through the bill of fare, and dismayed the garçon by the ravages he committed. But the emperor's friend covered himself with glory, for he danced everything, whether he knew it or not, and introduced impromptu pirouettes when the figures bewildered him. The boyish abandon of that stout man was charming to behold, for though he carried weight, he danced like an india-rubber ball. He ran, he flew, he pranced, his face glowed, his bald head shone, his coat-tails waved wildly, his pumps actually twinkled in the air, and when the music stopped, he wiped the drops from his brow and beamed upon his fellow men like a French Pickwick without glasses. Amy and her Pole distinguished themselves by equal enthusiasm but more graceful agility, and Laurie found himself involuntarily keeping time to the rhythmic rise and fall of the white slippers as they flew by as indefatigably as if winged. When little Vladimir finally relinquished her, with assurances that he was desolated to leave so early, she was ready to rest and see how her recreant knight had borne his punishment. It had been successful, for at 23, blighted affections find a balm in friendly society, and young nerves will thrill, young blood dance, and healthy young spirits rise when subjected to the enchantment of beauty, light, music, and motion. Laurie had a waked-up look as he rose to give her his seat, and when he hurried away to bring her some supper, she said to herself with a satisfied smile, "Ah, I thought that would do him good." "You look like Balzac's femme peinte par elle-même," he said, as he fanned her with one hand and held her coffee cup in the other. "My rouge won't come off," and Amy rubbed her brilliant cheek and showed him her white glove with a sober simplicity that made him laugh outright. "What do you call this stuff?" he asked, touching a fold of her dress that had blown over his knee. "Illusion. Good name for it. It's very pretty. New thing, isn't it? It's as old as the hills. You have seen it on dozens of girls, and you never found out that it was pretty till now? Stupid. I never saw it on you before, which accounts for the mistake, you see. None of that. It is forbidden. I'd rather take coffee than compliments just now. No, don't lounge. It makes me nervous." Laurie sat bolt upright, and meekly took her empty plate, feeling an odd sort of pleasure in having little Amy order him about, for she had lost her shyness now, and felt an irresistible desire to trample on him, as girls have a delightful way of doing when lords of creation show any signs of subjection. "Where did you learn all this sort of thing?" he asked with a quizzical look. "As this sort of thing is rather a vague expression, would you kindly explain?" returned Amy, knowing perfectly well what he meant, but wickedly leaving him to describe what is indescribable. "Well, the general air, the style, the self-possession, the illusion, you know," laughed Laurie, breaking down and helping himself out of his quandary with the new word. Amy was gratified, but of course didn't show it, and demurely answered, "Foreign life polishes one in spite of oneself. I study as well as play. And as for this," with a little gesture toward her dress, "why, tulle is cheap, posies to be had for nothing, and I am used to making the most of my poor little things." Amy rather regretted that last sentence, fearing it wasn't in good taste, but Laurie liked her the better for it, and found himself both admiring and respecting the brave patience that made the most of opportunity, and the cheerful spirit that covered poverty with flowers. Amy did not know why he looked at her so kindly, nor why he filled up her book with his own name, and devoted himself to her for the rest of the evening in the most delightful manner. But the impulse that wrought this agreeable change was the result of one of the new impressions which both of them were unconsciously giving and receiving. Chapter 38. On the Shelf. In France, the young girls have a dull time of it till they are married, when Vive la Liberté becomes their motto. In America, as everyone knows, girls early sign the Declaration of Independence and enjoy their freedom with Republican zest. But the young matrons usually abdicate with the first heir to the throne and go into a seclusion almost as close as a French nunnery, though by no means as quiet. Whether they like it or not, they are virtually put upon the shelf as soon as the wedding excitement is over, and most of them might exclaim, as did a very pretty woman the other day, "I'm as handsome as ever, but no one takes any notice of me because I'm married." Not being a belle, or even a fashionable lady, Meg did not experience this affliction till her babies were a year old. For in her little world, primitive customs prevailed, and she found herself more admired and beloved than ever. As she was a womanly little woman, the maternal instinct was very strong, and she was entirely absorbed in her children, to the utter exclusion of everything and everybody else. Day and night she brooded over them with tireless devotion and anxiety, leaving John to the tender mercies of the help, for an Irish lady now presided over the kitchen department. Being a domestic man, John decidedly missed the wifely attentions he had been accustomed to receive, but as he adored his babies, he cheerfully relinquished his comfort for a time, supposing with masculine ignorance that peace would soon be restored. But 3 months passed, and there was no return of repose. Meg looked worn and nervous. The babies absorbed every minute of her time. The house was neglected, and Kitty, the cook, who took life easy, kept him on short commons. When he went out in the morning, he was bewildered by small commissions for the captive mama. If he came gaily in at night, eager to embrace his family, he was quenched by a "hush! They are just asleep after worrying all day." If he proposed a little amusement at home, no, it would disturb the babies. If he hinted at a lecture or concert, he was answered with a reproachful look and a decided, "Leave my children for pleasure? Never." His sleep was broken by infant wails and visions of a phantom figure pacing noiselessly to and fro in the watches of the night. His meals were interrupted by the frequent flight of the presiding genius, who deserted him, half-helped, if a muffled chirp sounded from the nest above. And when he read his paper of an evening, Demi's colic got into the shipping list, and Daisy's fall affected the price of stocks, for Mrs. Brooke was only interested in domestic news. The poor man was very uncomfortable, for the children had bereft him of his wife. Home was merely a nursery, and the perpetual hushing made him feel like a brutal intruder whenever he entered the sacred precincts of Babyland. He bore it very patiently for 6 months, and when no signs of amendment appeared, he did what other paternal exiles do, tried to get a little comfort elsewhere. Scott had married and gone to housekeeping not far off, and John fell into the way of running over for an hour or two of an evening, when his own parlour was empty, and his own wife singing lullabies that seemed to have no end. Mrs. Scott was a lively, pretty girl, with nothing to do but be agreeable, and she performed her mission most successfully. The parlour was always bright and attractive, the chessboard ready, the piano in tune, plenty of gay gossip, and a nice little supper set forth in tempting style.